Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm Marina, and today I'm very delighted to talk to Kristen Gozzi, with whom a couple of weeks ago we discussed her newest book, Second World, Second Sex. Today, we will be talking about another book of hers, Red Hangover. It was published in 2017 and consists of essays and short stories about the legacies of the 20th century state socialisms. In Red Hangover, Kristen Gozzi asks a question that might sound provocative to many. Why are we ready to ignore the less than satisfactory realities of our existing democracies, but we dismiss the communist ideal, reducing it to the state socialism of the 20th century and especially the crimes of Stalinism? The book has 14 chapters divided into four parts, whose titles I will read because I feel they would orientate our listeners quite well in the content of the book we are discussing. So first part, is called Post-Socialist Freedoms, the second one, Reuniting the Divided, the third one, Blackwashing History, and the fourth and final one, Democracy is the Worst Form of Government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. So hello, Kristen, and thank you for being on the show today, and I hope I have summarized well the main question of your book. And
yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So I was wondering, could you tell us more about how you came to write this book, actually? It's so different from Second World, Second Sex. It's another type of book.
Definitely. So, you know, this is one of those projects that I did not really intend to do. I had a two-year sabbatical between 2014 and 2016. I was basically on leave from my previous job. I'd won a couple of grants, and I spent the first part of that year at the Freiburg Institute for Advanced Studies. And while I was at Freiburg, it's the case that when you're, especially if you're an American and you're in Europe, most European institutions, universities and such cannot afford to pay for transatlantic tickets for you to come speak. But if you happen to be based in Europe, they can pay for an inter-European ticket and accommodation. So while I was based in Freiburg this year of 2014-2015, I received invitations to speak in almost every single East European country. And since, it was pretty crazy. So in the course of that first year, I was traveling everywhere, constantly in Eastern Europe. And many times I flew a few times, but sometimes I was actually taking trains and driving and buses and things like that. And so I really had this sense of seeing Eastern Europe in 2014, 25 years after the fall of the wall, really from top to bottom, from Belgrade all the way up to Warsaw. And in the following year, I ended up in Helsinki. And so I was also in Tallinn and Vilnius and Riga. So then the following year, as I said, I moved to Eastern Germany, what was once Eastern Germany. I was based in Jena for 5 months. And then from Jena, I had a fellowship up in Helsinki. And so I was very much steeped in the writing of what was the book Second World, Second Sex that we talked about the last time we were on the we were discussing a book. But what happened was I was in Jena and there was this big neo-Nazi rally. And I could not believe the site of German neo-Nazis in this little town in the eastern part of Germany. And I started thinking a lot about, and then of course there was also a counter rally. Their sort of leftist, Jena at the time is a pretty lefty town, and Thuringia, the area of Germany where we were based at the time, was actually being governed by a red-green coalition with Die Linke and SPD and the Greens in charge. And so it was definitely these neo-Nazis come to Jena in order to provoke a counter-demonstration and to sort of show their power. Anyway, I started thinking a lot about the right wing. I had been living in Freiburg at the beginning of the Pegida rallies. These were this German group protecting the Occident against, you know, Islamic invasions. And obviously the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, which was this AfD party, which is now a member of the German parliament. And so I was sort of in the thick. I was living in the middle of all of this sort of rise of the right wing. And I'll also say that the summer of 2015, I was still in Germany, and it was the Greek, the Eurozone, the Greek crisis. Yanis Varoufakis and the prime minister of Greece, whose name I am completely blanking on right now, they were in Brussels trying to negotiate, you know, some deal. There was a vote. It was big sort of crisis of capitalism, and the Germans sort of bared their teeth, I would say. And so, I don't know, I sort of got swept up into the whirlwind of the failings of contemporary democratic societies, and certainly the failings of contemporary capitalism in Europe. And I started thinking about this in relation to Eastern Europe, because I was also traveling extensively in Eastern Europe at the time. And that summer of 2015, I actually was at a conference in Crete, and I was in Greece at the time, right before they were going to have this referendum about whether or not they should accept more austerity. And of course, as I'm sure you know, the Greeks voted no, that they didn't want Tsipras. Alexis Tsipras is the guy, the prime minister of Greece. As you know, the Greeks voted no against austerity, but then Tsipras basically accepted a deal. They had no choice, and they sort of forced the Greeks to accept more austerity. So all of that sort of got me writing and thinking, and I was very much disturbed by what I saw as a willingness on the part, especially I would say of the West Germans, but I would say, you know, more broadly across the continent, this idea that, oh, democracy isn't perfect. Oh, capitalism has all its problems, but, you know, we can fix it. We can make it, we can work it out. We can, you know, manage it somehow. It's better than any other option, you know. And then this other discourse in Eastern Europe where, you know, quite a lot of people were saying, well, you know, we have these experiences and everybody wants to talk about our lives as if we lived in one big Stalinist gulag, but that's not really how it was. There was this whole other world behind the Iron Curtain that people don't know about, and yet it's fixed historically in this one period of time.
So this is what got you thinking about all these essays that you have.
Absolutely. I mean, this was the thing about traveling. If you're on a bus or a train for a really long time, or planes and airports, you know, I was just writing a lot of reflections. And even though I should have really been working on that other book, I just couldn't help. It was a way, writing was a way for me to process what was happening in my own mind and in the world around me. And if you know, you know, from the preface of this book, it starts with me going to this museum and seeing the artifacts of an East German girl who was at summer camp around the same year that I would have been at summer camp, and just sort of thinking about the different experience of the world that we had, because she was raised in Eastern Germany and I was raised in Southern California. And I think, you know, the other thing is it's important in some cases, because I think, let's see, this book would have been my seventh book. And I've written a lot of, you know, traditional academic books before, but the one book that precedes this by a couple of years in 2011 was a book called Lost in Transition, which was, again, a series of essays and short stories, which in some ways I think is the book that has been most popular in terms of undergraduate teaching. I know a lot of colleagues, and I know from my publisher, that a lot of people teach that book because it's very accessible to young people and because it has these small little chunks, right? It's little essays, individual stories that can be taught independently of the rest of the book. So For me, I think being on leave and being away from the United States, sort of being away from my institution, made me feel a lot more creative and unleashed in terms of being able to write outside of the box and just sort of think through thoughts that were going through my head without really thinking that they needed to be in any particular form for a journal article or for a book chapter or for some op-ed or blog or something else that I was writing. I was just writing for myself. And Right. Yeah, it was, that's where it comes from. It comes from a place of trying to understand the world through writing.
Yes. My impression is also that it's very, very accessible book and very personal in a lot of ways. And I wanted to point the attention of our listeners to the title, which after I had read the book, and thank you for writing this book, it was my pleasure to read it. So I find this title very well fitting. So to give a little bit of context to our listeners, I will read a quote from the very last page of your book. Finally, to prevent the ascendance of a resurgent far right, we need to get past our red hangover and recognize the pros and cons of both liberal democracy and state socialism in an effort to promote a system that gives us the best of both. So could you briefly explain more about this metaphor of the red hangover? I understand it as a metaphor of both triumphalism and disappointment in an interesting way, but you'll tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically this idea. I mean, if you've ever had a hangover, right? anybody's ever gone out drinking pretty heavily will know that you sort of wake up the next morning, and the idea of even smell of alcohol is just so horribly repugnant, because you know your head is pounding and you feel sick to your stomach and you don't want to eat and you just want to stay in bed and you think, oh God, I'm never going drinking again, right? And so there's this period of time where you lay in bed and you say you hate yourself and it's full of self-loathing and full of regret. And you're like, I'm never, ever, 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 ever going to do that again. And I sort of feel like, you know, the socialist ideals, you know, there was this sort of 20th century binge drinking session with socialism.
Right.
And after 1989 or 1991, depending on where you are, you know, most of the world is basically laying in bed going, oh God, that was terrible. Why did we do that? That was such a bad idea. I'm never, ever, ever, ever going to flirt with socialism again. And I think that what has happened because of that, the red hangover, is we've allowed the right wing a lot of space and a lot of right wing ideologues, particularly, I mean, we can talk about this in the United States. We could talk about this in Poland or Hungary. We could talk about this in Russia or Turkey or Bulgaria. You know, there's lots of different examples of this. But I think that what's happened is that sort of working class issues of, you know, feeling alienated from capitalism, because the left is basically sitting around nursing this terrible headache from the 20th century, all of those people who might otherwise be attracted to sort of more socialist ideas have been attracted to the right wing. And so that's sort of the idea of this red hangover. And, you know, I don't know, different cultures have this saying, but in the United States, we have this thing called the hair of the dog, which is, you know, sometimes the best way to cure a hangover is to drink a little bit of alcohol and then the headache goes away. And, you know, I think that maybe after 30 years of nursing this terrible hangover from the experience of 20th century state socialism in Eastern Europe, maybe it's time that, you know, we take a little sip and start to clear our heads and figure out where we go from here.
Okay. Yes. Thank you for this explanation. This makes even more sense now that you have explained it. So you are often humorous and ironic in your writing, and one can sense it through the pages. So I was thinking about the first title of the title of the first part, which is Post-Socialist Freedoms, and then the texts within are nothing but, like, they're not about freedom at all. So it is an apparent irony. And the reality that you describe there is very, very grim, actually. It's the freedom to commit suicide, freedom of crime, freedom to be forgotten. And could you briefly talk about what all these oppressions to the people that you're writing about are, and how democracy have failed them?
Oh, this is a tough one. Okay, so the thing about this is that there are two competing narratives about the last 30 years. If you ask the economists and the political scientists, and if you look at GDP, and you look at other indicators of like life expectancy and things like that, you can say that the last 30 years of democracy have been a success for Eastern Europe. But in another respect, if you look, for instance, at out-migration and demographic decline and mortality issues, the countries of Eastern Europe, the top 10 countries with the fastest shrinking populations in the world are in Eastern Europe. These are countries that probably won't exist in 100 years because they'll be so incredibly depopulated. Also, you have incredible pockets of poverty. You have urban poor, you have rural poor, you have the elderly, you have levels of poverty and deprivation that were never seen before 1989. But you only see them if you go outside of the big cities, if you get outside of Bucharest, or you get outside of you know, Warsaw or Sofia or Belgrade or whatever. And I think that, I mean, and even, I mean, in the outskirts of the big cities, there's a wonderful book by my colleague Bruce O'Neill about homeless people and elderly homeless people in Bucharest in Romania. And he talks about how the government is desperately trying to get these people out of the center of the city to warehouse them in the outskirts of the city so that they're not in these urban spaces because nobody wants to see them. Nobody wants to see the losers of transition. And so for me, this part of the book is about the people that didn't do well, about all of the poverty and hardship that was created. Because even if you ask the economists and if you ask the political scientists and you say, well, what about the losers? What about the people who didn't thrive after 1989 or 1991? They will say, oh, well, that's their fault because they're communist, or, oh, they're just not suited to a global economy, or, oh, that's just how capitalism works. There have to be winners and losers. And on the whole, everybody is better off because of democracy and capitalism. And, you know, I mean, this is just a political point of view. And I just, as somebody who is an ethnographer who has been studying the region for as long as I have, you know, I think that we have to take people's suffering seriously. And when people are setting themselves on fire in front of the presidency's office out of despair, we should be paying attention. And the truth of the matter is nobody, I feel, in the World Bank, nobody in the IMF or the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development or in the EU is paying attention to the despair of the people who are the quote-unquote losers of transition. And so the post-socialist freedom section is really an attempt, my attempt, again, for myself, because, you know, two of them are essays and two of them are short stories, to make sense of the pain and the suffering, the very real suffering that was that has impacted many people in this region of the world that we just ignore because on the whole, things are better. You know, now you can go shopping at big shopping malls and you can buy, you don't have to wait 15 years to get an apartment and you can get jeans and Kent cigarettes or whatever it is that you need. So that's great. You can travel and you know, the Stasi are not watching you, but Google is. So Google is somehow better because it's a private corporation rather than the government. But the real suffering of the people that have been hurt by this, I think, is often ignored. And I wanted to pay some attention to them.
Right. It was terrifying to read these stories. And then I also really felt them maybe because of this kind of ironic expressions, if mm-hmm. I can say so. So now another question I have is about the forgetful young generation, the one born after 1989. So in chapter mm-hmm. 5, you describe a celebration of the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then you mentioned that you'll be posting in social media about it. And then there is a short sentence that you say that this post will not receive a wide attention in your Tumblr account because most of your Tumblr followers are born after 1989, like suggesting that this generation doesn't really care about the socialist past or even like to interpret the post-socialist realities.
Yeah.
So this is not only your observation. I have read a text. I remember reading a text by Albena Hranova. Maybe you know her, where she explores the ignorance and unwillingness of this generation to learn more about socialism. And I also happen to be one of those born after 1989 in Bulgaria. So I can see that this observation kind of like holds value. So why do you think this is the fact? Why is this massive oblivion? Why is this apathy? Would you comment on this maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a lot about this actually, because I have nephews, Bulgarian nephews who are 30 and 26, and they don't live in Bulgaria anymore, like so many Bulgarians don't. They live in Vienna. But I've often thought about their apathy and their unwillingness to sort of deal with it. And I think some of it is just they don't know who to trust. I think there's a real deep suspicion of all knowledge creation around issues of socialism. And I can give you multiple examples from my personal experience so that they don't trust the official textbooks because they know that those are hyper-politicized if there's even anything in them, right? I mean, you've got places like Ukraine passing laws to tell you what the correct history of socialism is. Mm-hmm. And if a newspaper or magazine questions that official history, they can be shut down by the government because they're proposing a different theory of history. I think there are older, your grandparents, my former mother and father-in-law, for instance, of the generation who sort of helped build socialism in Eastern Europe, many of whom are still alive. Obviously, they're suspicious of their narrative because they're nostalgic for their youth and they think everything was better in the past and the whole world is going to hell now. I mean, that's typical kind of conversation to have, right?
Right.
And then there are foreigners, right? Every time I write something about socialism, even if it's based on documents in the archive, or if it's based on people's personal experiences, or I'm looking at photo albums from the 50s, then people say, well, what do you know? You weren't born in a socialist country. You're an American. You know, you have no right to say anything like this. And then I was just at a conference last week with a young colleague of mine. She's 40. So she's Polish and she was 40. She is 40. So she was 10 when communism fell in Poland. And she writes a lot about the communist past. And of course, when she writes about the communist past, they say, well, you're too young. You don't understand. You don't know what it was really like because you were only 10 when it fell. So you can't trust the textbooks. You can't trust your grandparents. You can't trust the young people. And you can't trust the foreigners to tell you the truth about what happened in your own country for 40 years, if we're talking about Eastern Europe, or 70 years, if we're talking about the Soviet Union. So I think there's an incredible amount of suspicion and distrust, which then leads people to just be apathetic. They're like, if I can't know the truth, I don't want to know that. I don't care because I don't know what, it's sort of an epistemological crisis. How do you know what you know? And right. I think that much of the current discourse, if you think about in Eastern Europe, places like Romania have the Institute for Studying the Crimes of Communism, or in Bulgaria, there's an Institute for the Study of the Recent Past. All of these places are invested in producing the most negative images of the communist past possible. There are these institutes across Eastern Europe. And so, of course, they're the ones who are doing all this epistemic deplatforming, and they have incredible power to silence people who question their narrative. So I think, it's an epistemological crisis for many, many young people born in the region. How do you find an objective worldview about this past through which your own parents and obviously your grandparents lived?
Right. I remember what you have written about the exposition in the Museum of how was it in English, in about the Museum of Socialist Past, like yes. the one in Sofia, and how it has changed.
Yes. It's called the institution. It's the Museum of Socialist Art, right? Is what they wanted to call it, totalitarian art, but they settled on the socialist art. But it was a huge controversy what to call that museum.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge controversy because the original exhibit was just a celebration of art that was created during that period of time. And then the second exhibition, as I talk about in the book, was this really totalitarian art, right? With all of these pictures of, you know, busts of Lenin and things like that, and Stalin, and, you know, so it's there's still a fight going on in this part of the world over who gets to control this history. And I mean, it's not only, by the way, in Eastern Europe, it's happening in the United States too, right? We have our own Victims of Communism Foundation that does everything possible to produce as much negative anti-communist literature as possible. I mean, this is pervasive. This is not just in Eastern Europe. I just think in Eastern Europe, it affects young people in a particular way. And I should add, you know, it is worth mentioning here that some young people, and I have actually experienced this as well, do the opposite, right? Which is that they say, oh, communism is great. Was great. Like all of the stories about the gulag and the secret police and the travel restrictions and the consumer shortages, those are just lies that they're trying to tell us. And I think that's also problematic. I don't think that happens as much, but it does happen sometimes. People can be very uncritical about the past. They can romanticize the past. And so what I'm trying to say is we have to have a scholarly discussion or an informed political discussion about the past. That's what I'm hoping that my work allows people to do. And I'm very sympathetic to the idea that I'm not a Bulgarian or Pole or Czech or Slovak or German, you know, East German or whatever, Romanian. I understand that people are going to be critical of my point of view. And I also understand that they're going to be critical of my younger East European colleagues' point of view. And I understand that they might be a little dubious of my older East European colleagues' point of view. But if you're going to deplatform all of us, right, and you're going to say none of you have any right to say anything that's complicating this larger totalitarian narrative, then that narrative never gets complicated. And so I think that we all need to work together in a community to do our best to really engage with some of these important questions about, you know, what was the history of state socialism in Eastern Europe? How did people experience it? What were the real, you know, downsides? Obviously, there were many, but there were also some positive things. And can we talk about those?
On the note of positive things, I have a question for you. So mm-hmm. I got the impression that you argue in your book that people under state socialism were having sex or were having pets or were pursuing education for just the pure pleasure of it or because they like it, because mm-hmm. they don't have this measuring, because they don't have like this first financial incentive for some of these things, or they don't have this measurized view on those things, that like dogs are good for kids because they teach them to be responsible, let's say, or something.
right.
So could you tell us more about this idea of a better life quality under state socialism? Because I feel that this is something that some people might contest. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on this.
Right. And, you know, of course, this is a bit of an anachronistic argument because I'm sort of projecting back to the past what is a very much a contemporary condition in terms of the neoliberalization of the self. So what I try to talk about in the book, you know, and what I've done in my other work is to say, okay, if we want to know what effects the arrival of kind of turbo capitalism has on the individual, we need to look around the world and look for a natural experiment. And the natural experiment that I have found that I know the most of is the collapse of state socialism in 1989 or 1991 and the coming of capitalism and what that does to people's individual subjectivity. So the question is there a way, is there a certain way of being in the world that was unique to these countries because they had less influence in terms of market economy? In terms of, you know, and you could put this in a negative way, in the sense that hard work didn't really pay off. in the sense that you didn't have the kinds of opportunities that you have now in a capitalist economy, you know, to leave the country if you want to live abroad, to, you know, go into business and be an entrepreneur and sell people things that they don't need or whatever it is that you want to do. So, you know, different people look at this question differently. But my point in looking at this is as a natural experiment. And what I have found in the ethnographic literature and what I write about in this book and I've written about elsewhere is this idea that the neoliberalization of the self requires a sort of an unfettered market whereby you're constantly investing in your human capital because you think that investments in yourself, the kind of crafting of a particular personality or a crafting of a particular persona or the acquisition of a certain set of skills is going to allow you to succeed on the market. And so that every relationship, every action, everything that you do becomes a way of creating, to use a Bourdieuian term, of cultivating the habitus that's necessary for you to succeed in a capitalist economy. This is an argument that many people have made. You know, Wendy Brown talks about this. Nancy Fraser talks about this. More recently, a guy called Malcolm Harris wrote a beautiful book about this called The Kids These Days, The Making of Millennials. This way in which everything that we do becomes subsumed to this market logic. And I have argued, obviously, that our intimate relations are becoming increasingly subsumed to market logic. So here's what the ethnographic literature on socialism that I have read so far clearly points is that people, you know, again, this is a negative thing. Because people didn't have the same sorts of opportunities, because there weren't these, you know, markets, because people were guaranteed a certain level of social security and economic stability, they, even if you had to live with your parents, you had an apartment and you had heat and you had healthcare and you had opportunities for education for your children to a certain extent. There was less of this constant investment and attention to the cultivation of the personal, individual, human capital of the habitus in order to succeed. The habitus of socialism was different. This is not a newsflash to anybody. The habitus of socialism is going to be particular to socialism. But people like Maria Todorova, you know, people who have done research in Eastern Europe on, you know, various populations, talk about one of the things that people miss the most is the unique sociality of socialism. There was a way in which you did things because you did them, not because you were investing in your own human capital for later use in a market economy. You did them because you did them. Now, some people were working the system. They joined the Komsomol. They joined the party. They were thinking of their careers in this non-market way or whatever. But a lot of people who weren't interested in joining the party or who weren't interested in becoming members of the Komsomol, they just sort of lived their lives and they had relationships and they did things independent of these kinds of market logics. And that's the thing that I'm really interested in studying. So I'm not trying to romanticize the past. And a lot of people have accused me of doing that. I'm trying to understand comparatively how the habitus of socialism allows us to think about what a non-capitalist habitus would look like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. Yeah, it does make sense. I had a question here. It's maybe not really related to what you said, but I was also thinking about everything that you had in this chapter where it is, what was the name of the chapter once again? The one about people having sex, better sex under socialism, this one.
Yeah.
And then there, so like a question in parentheses while we are on the topic. So there you say like you see pornography as capitalist commodification of sex in a way. But I agree here. But what strikes me, and I would like a comment from you as a person who and the researcher who has invested so much time studying Eastern Europe, what strikes me is that Bulgaria, like after the fall of communism and like while I was growing up, basically Sofia and Bulgaria were covered with all these very pornographic posters advertising alcohol and cars. And I have traveled to other countries, Western countries, around the same time that we have had, and we still have these posters actually. And like in Germany or here in Canada, I don't really see such posters. So could you kind of like reflect on this, on pornography, like in the context of post-socialism, and why is it embraced in this way and so much by countries which previously didn't have such attitude to sex?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are two things. The first is obviously it was banned, right?
Right, yeah.
You couldn't get it before, right? So I think that the thrill of some of that imagery is still there for, you know, many people who grew up under socialism. That there, I have spoken, you know, to people who talk about the erotic, you know, deficit of socialism, right? Like that there wasn't enough pornography, right? There were, you know, now, and again, I think that's, you know, that's in some ways that's specific to certain countries. I mean, obviously Bulgaria was on the pruder side of the spectrum. Yugoslavia had its own kind of state-run soft porn magazine. And certainly Eastern Germany and Czechoslovakia were much more open about sexuality. I mean, Bulgaria was in the middle here. But yeah, but I think after socialism, it was just this explosion of this these images that were, let's face it, pretty degrading to women, largely. Right. And then, you know, the second part of the question is it just works? As long as it still works in Bulgaria to sell people cars and beer and tires by putting a, you know, very low, or mastika, you know, I remember these ads where girls, they had these bikini tops that were watermelons. They were so, they were so outrageous, but they work. If you're the head of an advertising agency and your goal is to get people to buy more beer or your brand of beer or your brand of mastika, then it makes sense to use the advertising strategy that's going to be most effective. And it turns out that that's really effective still. And so I think it is a reflection of this commodification of women that didn't really exist before. And it's, you know, if you grow up, I completely sympathize with this because these images are just everywhere. And they feel kind of, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but it's definitely a noticeable difference between a major East European capital and let's say Western Europe or the United States or Canada for that matter. It's just a different sense of how you're going to represent sexuality. And in the case of you know, after 1989, sexuality is something that is used to sell things. And I think that it's important to reflect on the fact that sexuality wasn't always used to sell things in that way. And that in and of itself is an important difference. It's just a fact. It's, you know, it's not a big conspiracy. It's just a reality, right? If you are going to use women's bodies, you know, in a particular way to sell things, you are commodifying sexuality. You're making people feel insecure. You're saying, hey, mister, you on the street, if you drink my brand of mastika, then you will be able to have sex with a woman who looks like this. That's what the message is, right?
Right.
It's kind of ridiculous that it works, but it does work because people are feeling insecure and they think, oh, sexuality is something that has a market and I can increase my market value by drinking this kind of drink. I mean, that's how a lot of advertising works, right?
Yeah. Just my question was rather why it does work so well in the post-socialist countries. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's not so much the case. Like, I guess it would work maybe in other countries as well, but it's just banned there to have these kind of posters. So like this particular...
I think there's more of a backlash against those kinds of posters, right? I mean, these really, really degrading images often get backlash, right? So feminist groups will call them out. You know, advertising alliances, there are, you know, groups that protect children or something like that. I mean, I do think there's just a lot more activism in the West around the kinds of images that are going to be put up in public spaces. And certainly, you know, to the extreme in a place like the United States, if somebody put up a mastika, you know, a poster like that in their office, you know, some of their female colleagues could say that they're creating a hostile work environment, right? I mean, there have been cases like that. So I just think there's a lot more sensitivity around the fact that these images make people very uncomfortable and children uncomfortable, right? than in Eastern Europe, where the idea is that we should be free to do whatever we want because we were banned, you know, we were prohibited from doing all these things for so long. I mean, I do think that there's this wonderful article, I can't remember if I mentioned it in my last recording with you, Zombie Socialism, by these young Romanian scholars. And they talk about the way that constant reference to the communist past is used to justify lots of terrible things in the present. Like, and I think one of the things in the present that it's used to justify is anti-feminism and anti, you know, a lot of anti-women, anti-gender sentiments, right? The idea that somehow the communist past sort of gave women, you know, supported women in this really generous way is one reason to reject any sort of idea of feminism. So, I mean, people have written about that. That's not my idea. That's an idea that's been floating around for a long time. But I do think there's something to that. The Zombie Socialism articles talk specifically about social rights. Like if you want to, you know, build a great, better public transportation, or you want to, you know, reduce university fees or do something that requires the state, people will scream socialism. And essentially what zombie socialism allows the elites to do is to justify an inequitable distribution of wealth in the present day by referring to any efforts to tax and redistribute that wealth as socialism.
Right, right. Thank you for this comment. This was really very much in parentheses because your book doesn't really talk about pornography as much. This was very maybe out of what you have expected to be asked.
Okay.
Yeah. And I also think here as a comment that maybe here it's all again this apathy that we have discussed of people in this post-socialist countries who wouldn't really react because they don't think that it makes sense to react. Like even those that would be opposed would say this is degrading or something, would say like nothing is ever gonna change if I say my opinion. So this might also contribute
exactly.
to why yeah. these things continue right. to be there.
And also, I mean, let's just face it, the people who might actually say something and protest, they've left.
Yeah.
There's so few young people, right? The out-migration statistics from a place like Bulgaria or Romania are huge, right? There's been a massive exodus of young people who settle in the West and don't really have intention to come back. You know, they might come back in the summers for a couple of weeks, but they don't really intentionally think to make long-term life in Bulgaria or Romania or wherever. And so why fight it, you know? I think I was there in 2013 when you had the first protest in February, and then you had these huge civic protests in Sofia in the summer of 2013, which was, you know, in the lead up to writing this book. And people really thought that things were going to change. And look, I mean, as I say in the book, you know, Borisov is still prime minister.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. So it's, you know, you can go out on the streets and you can do all sorts of things. You could try to make a difference. But if you don't feel like anything is going to change, it's not only that you become apathetic, it's that you leave.
Right, right, right. You have summarized the political debates. I want to go back to the book. So you have summarized the political debates of the Cold War period in a sentence that I think it's best to quote. So it says, "Where the United States guaranteed rights such as freedom of speech, religion, assembly, and private property, the Soviet Union guaranteed rights such as full employment and state provision of a basic social safety net through which, at least theoretically, no one would be allowed to fall." End of quote. So, in your personal opinion, are these sets of rights mutually exclusive? So, some of the debates around them have been putting them in this opposing light. So, could we have both sets of rights? What is your opinion on this?
Obviously, that is the ideal, as far as I'm concerned. Right. Right? I think the reason that they are often considered mutually exclusive is because that was the position of the Soviet Union and the United States at the United Nations during the Cold War. To the extent that the Soviet Union and its allies were pushing for social and economic rights, they would say, "Well, in order to have these, we have to have certain kinds of, you know, policies about preventing dissent." And the United States would say the opposite, right? In order for us to have full political freedoms, we can't guarantee people any sort of social safety net because that impinges on the freedoms of people to get rich and the freedoms of employers and so on and so forth. So I think they've always been in opposition. But obviously, at the end of the book, I say very clearly that I'm, you know, hoping that there is a world in which we can have the political freedoms of speech and assembly and religion and thought and travel and so on and so forth, but combine it with some sort of world in which we have rights, human rights, that include some form of guaranteed employment and a basic social safety net that allows us to thrive so that we're not living in this precarious gig economy and taking out, you know, bucket loads of student debt and selling our affections and our attentions on the internet to the highest bidder. I think that there is a way in which, you know, there was a vision of the world that was going to try to reconcile these two things, and it didn't happen. It's clear that it hasn't happened. You know, I think some societies may have gotten closer than others, but, you know, if you look at places perhaps like Scandinavia, but I do think that's the ideal. They're not mutually exclusive. They shouldn't be mutually exclusive, but unfortunately, especially in the United States, because the United States is still a hegemon, the United States, if you listen to any kind of popular discourses now against people like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the whole narrative is if we allow any form of socialism, even something like healthcare, which, as you know, they have in Canada and the UK and everywhere else, our basic freedoms will be violated, right? They're going to take away your hamburgers and your pickup trucks. They're going to take away your ability to take a plane ride. You know, all of the scaremongering in the United States by people who are anti-socialism or anti-democratic socialism or anti-social democracy, I mean, because basically we're talking about social democracy when we're talking about Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez, it's all framed in this language of human rights, of basic fundamental freedoms. People on the right will say it's liberty. You have to defend liberty. And liberty requires that we don't have healthcare, that we don't pay for higher education, that we don't have maternity leaves, that we don't have kindergartens and creches. That's liberty. The liberty to succeed requires no state intervention in the economy. And I think that's the problem, is that language still very much exists in the United States, less so in Europe, and less so even more in Scandinavia, but it's still very prevalent.
So yes, like my impression of this book was very interesting thing. And I think each book about the past should achieve this. It was about the past, but it was also about the present and the future. So it definitely has a message. And I think that you just phrased it. You just expressed the message of the whole book in a way. And I had another question, which really kind of like personally bothers me in a way. So I don't know whether you have read some of the writings of Georgi Markov, who has escaped from, like, he's a kind of like a dissident from the communist regime, and he has been really, really critical about it, like the communist regime in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. And I clearly remember one of his writings was very much talking about this looking for an enemy everywhere. I might need to explain more, but like the whole communist project in Eastern Europe, the way that I know about it, let's say it like this, let's phrase it like this, was based on this idea of always looking for an enemy, which could be an internal or an external enemy. And there was a lot of like witch hunt that employed Marxist that revolutionary language, that these people, those are like our enemies, they're the bourgeois, they're exploiting us and so on. And having an enemy is very, very convenient for authoritarian, I'd say, government, and it helps manipulate popular opinions. So it's maybe not characteristic of only the socialist regime, because a right-wing regime would also look for an enemy, like Hitler was pointing out to the Jews in this very same way, right? Like for like,
or Donald Trump with the Mexicans, right?
Right. but still, this looking for an enemy was a main explanation for intercepting people, for imprisoning them, for killing many people. So this is the so hated Stalinism that you want to escape, because it's really it's not right to reduce state socialism to Stalinism, but still,
it happened, absolutely.
And do you think that the socialist project is like even possible without this kind of like polarizing that makes people look for enemies, and those who are differently thinking are the enemies, and so on? So does this even kind of like exist somewhere, or is it possible?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the one thing I want to say is it absolutely happened. You know, we talk about this, the purges in the Soviet Union in the 30s, and all of the horrible sort of kangaroo courts and trials, show trials that happened in the late 40s and the 1950s across Eastern Europe as these communist parties consolidated power, obviously with the support of Stalin. So I think that we should never ignore that. It should always be discussed that any attempt to pretend that that's not an important part of the history of 20th century state socialism is wrongheaded. And I think that I get very angry when people try to pretend that I'm not paying attention to that part of the history. The Left Side of History, which is one of my other previous books, deals very specifically with that period of time, because as I'm sure you know, many of the people who were purged in all of these cases were in some ways the more ideologically pure communists, the people who really believed in the larger project and really thought that they were creating an alternative worldview, and they wanted to do something for the people, so to speak. And then the sort of opportunistic leaders, the much more paranoid leaders, the much more aggressive leaders are the ones who come into power and purge all of the real idealists. And I think that that's a part of the history that we need to deal with. Like, it's not just that there was paranoia. It's not like, you know, they suddenly drank this, they read this communist text and they suddenly became paranoid and they started going crazy. It was that there were these real fissures in between different factions of the party. As you, I'm sure you know from history, leftists have been very good at forming circular firing squads. They tend to turn on each other. The minute the revolution is won, they go after each other. So this is a big problem with leftist politics in general. It has been a problem from the very beginning. I think personally, it's still a problem. And that the minute any sort of successful social movement is achieved, social, you know, revolution or social ideology is achieved, often the people who work together to achieve that turn on each other. Now, it happens that in Eastern Europe, they turned on each other in this really, really horrible way. And I can't, you know, I'm not a fortune teller. So yes, that happened in the past. Your question is it bound to happen always, forever in the future? And that is the question I just don't know the answer to. I'm hoping that it's not. I hope that if there is an experiment with some of these ideas, that it won't be a totalitarian or authoritarian version of these ideas, that there's, again, as we talked about a little bit earlier, this combination of political rights with economic rights, and that there's always a risk when you're creating a societal upheaval of any type, that there's going to be this factionalization and infighting, and that that can quickly turn to brutality. So I think that when we talk about 20th century state socialism and communism in particular in Eastern Europe, I think that we have to talk about this period. The writings of people like Georgi Markov are really important. And, you know, there are many, many books about this period of history. In fact, this is the period of communist history that we probably know the best because it's been so well researched and so well written about, and that young people should read those histories as well. They should be front and center. They should not be ignored. But I do think to say, okay, this thing happened in the 20th century, therefore all of the ideas associated with the people who committed those crimes are forever tainted by those crimes is a problem. Because as I've pointed out in the book, in the United States, things like democracy, our concept of democracy here is can be very clearly linked with genocide against the Native American population, can be linked with slavery, can be linked with the massive unemployment and, you know, human suffering of the Great Depression, can be linked with Japanese internment camps and Jim Crow and lynching. But when we think about democracy, we don't link the concept of democracy specifically to the most negative examples of the history of the democracy. And of course, we could look at Britain and look at the Boer War. We could look at the Bengal famine. There are all sorts of examples of terrible things that have happened in the name of capitalism and democracy. But we don't reduce the entire history of capitalism and democracy to those terrible things. But when we look at the history of communism or the history of state socialism, we reduce the entire history to these specific things. And that's, I mean, I understand this is a very nuanced point to make, and it may sound like I'm trying to be an apologist for Stalin, which I am not. I think we should recognize those crimes. They existed. There were purges and labor camps and gulags. However, those don't become the entire history of communism and socialism, and they certainly shouldn't limit the entire future of these ideologies, because that just seems like a weird internal contradiction, which is another point that I try to make in this book.
Mm-hmm. And I think this relates to what we have talked in the previous interview about, like, the winners writing the
history.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of this in this reducing to of socialism to Stalinism, and then it wouldn't really make sense to have so many nostalgic people of the past if it was all repressions, right? If it was all interception and killing and no freedom at all. So people have found something to be nostalgic about, and we shouldn't maybe dismiss them about being nostalgic. Like, I remember you quoting Jana Hensel, which whose book I have also read in the past, and she kind of like described very much her everyday life as a child in Eastern Germany, and I remember being very impressed, and the whole idea of this everyday life being lost, totally lost, and how she took this as a personal grief in a way. Mm-hmm. I really remember this book, and it kind of like has impacted my way of thinking about the past, the socialist past, which I tend to see mostly through this more, let's say, repressive lens. So mm-hmm. for me, reading your book was very informative, and also because it was so accessible and very provocative in a way, it made me think about the past, and it really achieves this aim to complicate the history.
I'm glad that it had that effect, because I think that, you know, it's not without controversy, so to speak. And it's not just me who's doing this. I think there are young, like you mentioned, Jana Hensel, but there are also young scholars in the region, many of them, by the way, who are studying in Western universities, but are from the region, who are also trying to do this work. And there's an incredible mm-hmm. hostility to this work. So in some ways, it delights me that you saw the sort of difficult process of trying to complicate what is, you know, admittedly a very complicated history with a lot of repression in it. But as you point out, the fact that people are nostalgic, it's not just a mass delusion, which I think is what a lot of people want to say, that it's just this massive delusion that people are having that the past was somehow better. But it has to do with the loss of, as I mentioned earlier, the sociality and also this sense of economic stability and social security that people just don't have anymore. And yes, it comes at this terrible cost. It shouldn't have to come at that cost, but it did. But people do remember it. And I think that we shouldn't just discount them for remembering it.
Yes, I agree here. And I would like to have like a final question that's on a little bit kind of like lighter note.
Sure.
About one of my maybe personal favorites in your book, which was A Tale of Two Typewriters, because it was so light and so in a way humorous, but still dealing with all these questions. And I also felt like somehow your personality and you combining this like imaginary and humorous, but also this all like difficult questions and these political things. So my question about it would be, maybe I should say to, for the listeners that you dare talk about two typewriters, one of them produced and owned in Western Germany and the other one produced and owned in Eastern Germany. So could you briefly discuss on this whole idea of objects being able to reflect history and the importance of everyday life when imagining the past?
Sure. Yeah, so I wrote that. First of all, I'm a big typewriter collector, so I have a huge passion for manual typewriters. And while I was in Germany, I was collecting a lot of them. So I end up with these two really interesting typewriters that have very different histories based in these two different economic systems. And at the time, I was reading a lot of the new materialisms literature and this idea of trying to decenter the human and really think about objects and their the way that they create narratives of history. Mm-hmm. And so it was an attempt for me to try to get at a new materialist view of history, of this sort of state socialist history compared to West, you know, Western German, East German versus West German history through these objects. And then, of course, I end up anthropomorphizing the objects because I just can't help it. I want, you know, I want there to be voices. And so I just sort of gave up on trying to make it. And I also felt like it was a little boring just telling the history of these two objects without giving them a voice. So I let them speak in the chapter. Mm-hmm. And I think that what was so fun about that was that here were these two very garden variety objects, just two manual typewriters. And they exist, you know, one of them I bought, you know, from like a flea market, and the other one I bought in an antique store. And I started thinking about their histories. And I love the history of everyday life and the ways in which our everyday material realities are what really truly shape our sort of larger ideological constructs. And I think this is where people, to come back exactly to your previous question, when we think about state socialism and communism in Eastern Europe, we think about the ideology and we think about the repressive apparatus, the structural things that were very negative about it. But we don't pay enough attention to the material realities of people, of people's everyday life. And if you sink down to the very basic things of people's cupboards and people's bookshelves and people's typewriters and, you know, people's villas and dachas and people's experiences of being at the seaside and you know, and the colorful beach towel or whatever that you might have had, the material reality of people's lives is what people remember about the past. It's very easy to forget the ideology when the ideology changes. It's the objects. It's the way we interact with these material things often that are the things that sort of ground our memory and ground our experience of a certain period of time. So, you know, if you have the experience of an olfactory memory where you smell something and it suddenly brings you back like 20 years, like, oh my God, it's the most powerful memory, these sensory things. And so the importance of what I think of as social history or of cultural anthropology, ethnography, the kind of work that I'm interested in doing is precisely to tell the stories of ordinary people and to tell the stories of ordinary objects. I'm not so interested in the larger superstructure. I'm not so interested in the larger, you know, ideological questions. I really want to experience things from the bottom up. And I think that that's a part of the story. Those are stories and narratives that don't always get told, but that need to be told because they give us a very different view on not only the past, but I would say our present.
Yes, exactly. I feel the same way. And this is my, why I have chosen to like, study anthropology in the first place. And yes, so I was wondering, like, just like a fun question added to this, to the last one. So if you could like curate the exhibition Bulgaria's socialist past, what kind of like objects would you include if you could like think of your like on the top of your mind?
Right. There's actually a lovely book called An Inventory of Socialism.
Yes, I remember this. Yes, I was thinking about it while I'm asking.
Exactly.
You.
Yeah. And so, and also, I don't know if you read the book Sotsgorme, which is also about sort of cooking. There's a great, it's sort of, I think it's like a cookbook, a history of cuisine, Bulgarian cuisine from socialism.
No, so, I haven't read this one.
Oh, you should get this one. It's really, really fun. But I think, the inventory is the thing, all of these little things that are collected there, right? The bomboni and the little, sashes, the young pioneer pins and the hats and the dolls and the plastic trucks, the Maritsa typewriters. I'm a big, fan of the Maritsa 2 typewriter, basically. So there are all these very, material things, and they are still in people's homes. When I'm in Sofia, I'm always on the lookout for things that were, manufactured before 89. I'm always curious what has survived, mm-hmm. And I think a lot of things, material things, blankets and sheets, pillowcases, right? If they haven't been thrown away, they're still around. And there are these material aspects of people's lives, especially, I think if I were to do it with my friends, a lot of my friends, especially who grew up in, who were like teenagers or young adults in the 80s, because there wasn't a lot of fashion, as you can imagine, there wasn't mm-hmm. a lot of Western fashion. People, most of the women and quite a few of the men either designed clothes and sewed them themselves. So they made these clothes that were sort of based vaguely on Western fashions, but they were kind of like adapted. So people bought material and they made these clothes. And a lot of people who made clothes in the 80s have kept them because they couldn't bear to throw them away, because they put a lot of effort into making them. So it would be really fun to show the creativity, I think, of late socialism, people's wardrobes and how they like maybe made like fake Nike sneakers or they made fake Adidas track pants or things like that. In addition to the kind of very material inventory of socialism, which has, I think, already been done in that lovely book. And then I would love to do, these sort of cooking things, right? The way that people got really creative with food. If you have Sirene and Kashkaval, like those are your major cheeses, right? You can't do all the fancy things with cheeses that you can do in the West when you're cooking Western cuisine. But, I was always surprised at how creative people could be with white cheese and yellow cheese. it's amazing that all the sorts of different dishes you could have with just these two basic types of cheeses. So I think it would be a really fun exhibition actually to do. And it would require a lot of, curating of people and, having people go through their old, their basements and their old suitcases and figuring out what they have left from that era. And of course, the other thing is the photographs and the photo albums. To the extent that people have images from the past, I think those are also really interesting to talk about because people have stories about those pictures, where they were, what they were doing, who they were with. And I think those are also really important narratives to hear that we often don't hear because we don't really care about, individual people's personal photo albums, but that would be a fun exhibition as well.
Yeah, you should think of like organizing such a thing maybe in the future if you have time.
Fun. Like 80s fashion, a homemade 80s fashion would be a really fun.
Whoa, really yeah.
Fun. Like 80s music and yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this would be really a fun thing to do and also valuable because people would remember and it would trigger memories and it would trigger stories maybe to be told. I just find such things so great.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that, I want to emphasize people were so creative, when you didn't have a mall with endless choices to choose from, you got creative and people were, incredibly thoughtful about curating fabrics and buttons and, bits of lace and, because the 80s was a weird fashion decade, neon things. So you had to be really creative in order to make the clothes look a particular way. And you see pictures from that era and I think, wow, it's, again, I don't want to romanticize it, but I do think that it shows the tenacity of the human spirit, that people are going to have fun and dress nice and make meaning out of their lives, no matter what the larger political situation is. That we know for sure. That's just a pervasive historical reality. And we should be attentive to the ways in which people negotiate power and authority to make, you know, their lives a little bit less depressing, a little bit more joyful, because that's what we all really want in the end, at the end of the day, right?
Right, right. So I think I have taken you a lot of time with this interview. It's already an hour. So I was wondering, we could close up with a question that's, so you, the book is written 2 years ago. So if you would write the book today, would there be things that you would include from the past 2 years? Like, do you have a change of the perspective or just more things to add, or yes?
I think that at the time that I was writing the book, I probably felt a little bit apocalyptic after Brexit and the election of Trump.
Right.
I definitely think at that moment it felt really awful. And, you know, looking at, for instance, Kaczynski in Poland or Orban in Hungary and sort of, you know, but also Le Pen in France and things like that. So I think I was definitely feeling a little bit more bleak than now, that the latest European elections, the right wing, the far right wing didn't do as well as people feared. And there's a limit to the appeal of some of these really right-wing ideologies. And I also think that the left, in its own fits and starts, is sort of getting itself together. And I hoped that that would happen, I guess, but I wasn't sure how it was going to happen. And the success of somebody like Bernie Sanders in the United States, or the popularity of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or, you know, the somebody like Kevin Kühnert in Germany, who's the youth leader of the SPD, there is movement, and there are people who are standing up and who are resisting. And I think that I maybe underestimated a little bit. I was feeling a little depressed living in Europe in 2014, 2015, 2016, and especially coming back to the United States in 2016 with Trump as president was difficult for me. But again, I think that there is hope, and maybe I would have tried to be a little bit more hopeful. But a book is what it is. It's who you are when you wrote it. And the book was published in 2017, but it's important to realize that it was written in 2015-16.
So I think that it
reflected the anxiety that I felt in Europe at the time with the rise of things like Pegida and the AfD and the resurgence of the right. So that's the only thing that I would change. I think that maybe I was a little bit too paranoid, and that I would dial it back a little bit and say, hey, there are really more concrete ways to fight this. If we work together and we find common cause. But as I said, you know, the book is where you were when you wrote it. So.
Yes. Yes, of course. So thank you so much for this interview, for this conversation. I find that we touched upon a lot of things, and really thank you for giving me your time in this way, and maybe we will do another interview. We'll see.
Yes.
You're so productive.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. We have so many books to talk about.
Yeah. So, but for now, I think I'm just, I need to do a lot of reading. I'm in the moment right now where I'm going to be reading a lot. I want to catch up on what other people are saying. And I'm hoping that, you know, there are a lot of really smart people out there, but especially scholars in the region and from the region who are doing really important work. And I think that there is a moment here where we can all learn from each other. And so I'm hoping that we can also build these communities, intellectual and scholarly and activist communities across, you know, generations as well as borders. And so that's my current state of mind is one of consumption rather than production.
Okay. So good luck with reading and connecting with other authors. And I'm glad we had you today. And have a good day.
Thanks. Yeah, you too. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.